the Black History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Nishad Carrington. I'm a little bit under the weather with a little bit of a cold, but we're going to power through this episode anyway, because it's a very, very special one. In fact, it's been specifically requested on more than one occasion, and it's an episode that I'm really am proud to have a part in researching and presenting to you today. Now, the name is synonymous with freedom and legacy and revolution, but in truth, how many listeners actually know the history of Haiti and its pathway from colonization to independence? It's often been said that no revolution or changing of the guard occurs without violence and struggle and bloodshed, whether it be the French, Russian, American, Intifada, Chechen, Egyptian, Iranian, Cuban, or Haitian. At any time a people rise up and resist against the establishment, there is bound to be bloodshed and lives lost. And though there are any number of catalysts to these worldwide revolutions, often there are factors of society, economics, human rights abuses, etc. The question in many minds, mine included, is usually who was the driving force for such revolt? Well, today we're going to dive really, really deep and discuss this very individual in Haiti. As always, I'll provide you with the same standard disclaimer. If you have young children listening to this episode, I would actually encourage you to give it a listen first and determine its appropriateness for your children. As with any struggle or violent clash, this episode will be ripe with violence and descriptions of violence that may not be right for your child, but only you can make such a determination. So if for any reason this episode is too violent for young ears, I encourage you to skip this one, but it'd be a disservice for us to not provide the truth and actuality of the situation. With that said, let's get into it. Second side note, this is probably one of the longer episodes that we've done more recently, but that's also because in order to understand the climate that breeds revolution, you must understand with specificity the history and sociological structure of a place. Now, the island of Hispaniola is the 22nd largest island on Earth, and for those that may not know, it is located in the Caribbean island group. Of the islands in the Caribbean, it is the second largest following Cuba, and the 11th most populous island worldwide. The present-day makeup of the island is in fact split between two countries, the Spanish-speaking Dominican Republic and the French Creole-speaking Haiti. The only other island shared between two countries in the Caribbean is Saint Martin, which is shared between France and the Netherlands. Before the first recorded arrival of Europeans in 1492, the island of Hispaniola was inhabited by the Arawak, also known as the Taino and the Carib people. Prior to the arrival of the great destroyer Christopher Columbus, historians have estimated that the island population ranged anywhere from 60,000 to 600,000 people. Though being known by numerous names by the indigenous people, when Columbus arrived, he declared the name to be Insula Hispana in Latin and La Isla Española in Spanish, with both meaning the Spanish island. The oldest documented map of the island was created by Andres de Morales, and it labeled the region Montes de Haiti, or Haiti Mountains, and the portion of the island was given the common name based on the identification of that particular region. So let's talk Columbus for a quick second, and truthfully, I have no desire to give a murderer any more time than necessary. Columbus inadvertently landed at Hispaniola in 1492 during his first voyage across the Atlantic Ocean, as his ship, the Santa Maria, sank after running aground on December 25th. Some of Columbus's men were left at an outpost they coined La Navidad on the northern coast of present-day Haiti. Columbus and the others left to return the following year, but had to find a new place to garrison because as La Navidad was destroyed by the indigenous populations. So they actually went east into present-day La Isabella, Dominican Republic. Now, I'm sure you can imagine Columbus and his cohorts brought destruction, disease, and abhorrently brutal forced labor practices with them that nearly annihilated the native population within 50 years of his arrival. Harsh enslavement by Spanish colonists redirection of food supplies and labor towards the colonists, had a devastating impact on both mortality and fertility over the first quarter century. And by 1517, only about 14,000 of the native Tainos survived. Because of the decimation of the native populations, in 1503, the Spanish colonies began importing African slaves who were believed to be more capable of performing physical labor. I'm sure most listeners to the show are educated, whether formal or informal, and as such are aware of the diseases that many European colonists brought to the Americas on their arrival. Well, according to the record, the first outbreak of smallpox in Hispaniola occurred in 1518 amongst enslaved Africans. As I'm sure you can imagine as well, enslaved Africans and natives to the Americas had no natural immunity to European diseases, and by May of 1519, as many as a third of the remaining natives had died. As Spain expanded their exploration and colonization in the Caribbean, their interest in Hispaniola waned, and the population on the island grew very, very slowly. Now, this wane of interest in the island was predominantly due to the fact that significant gold and silver deposits were found in present-day Mexico and other parts of South America. The fact that the island wasn't well populated meant it wasn't well protected by the Spanish either. And by the early 1600s, the island and nearby Tortuga became regular stopping points for pirates from France, England, and the Netherlands. These pirates were able to establish their own outposts and colonies on the northern and western portions of Hispaniola. Now, I'm going to jump ahead a couple of years, not too far, but in 1665, French colonization of the island was officially recognized by then French King Louis XIV. Initially, the colony was given the name Saint-Domingue, and in 1697, by the way of the Treaty of Ryswick, Spain formally ceded the western third of Hispaniola to France. Saint-Domingue was very quickly overtook. The Spanish held eastern portion of the island, both in wealth and population, and earned the nickname Pearl of the Antilles, and would eventually come to be the richest and most prosperous colony in the West Indies. Of course, as most colonies in the Western Hemisphere, this growth and prosperity was built on the back of an entrenched system of slavery, with the primary cash crop being sugarcane during a time when demand for sugar was at an all-time high in Europe. Slavery, of course, would keep prices of sugar low, and profit was maximized at the expense of human life. Saint-Domingue was becoming one of the most important shipping, import, and export ports in all of the Americas, with goods, products, and human capital even flowing to and from Europe, France, Africa, and the Americas. European colonists had a tough time maintaining Caribbean colonies, mainly because they had no natural immunities to tropical fevers and the numerous violent rebellions raised by enslaved persons who outnumbered the colonists. On February 4th, 1794, the conclusion of the French Revolution outlawed slavery in the colonies, but the rise of Napoleon and his instituted policies reimposed slavery in the colonies in 1802. But of course, this reimposition didn't sit well with the recently freed but formerly enslaved persons, and in turn led to a major upheaval by the same. In order to promptly reconstitute the institution of slavery, Napoleon sent French troops to the colonies, but like many of their predecessors, these troops had no natural immunity to many of the tropical diseases, and more than half of the troops died from yellow fever during the following summer. In 1803, the French removed the remaining 7,000 troops who managed to survive, and the leaders of the revolution declared Western Hispaniola to be the new and independent nation of Haiti in early 1804. Even after this declaration, French continued to rule Spanish Santo Domingo, but in 1805, Haitian troops led by General Henry Christophe tried to conquer all of Hispaniola, invading Santo Domingo and destroying the towns of Santiago de los Caballeros and Moca, killing most of the inhabitants. But French reinforcements came towards Haiti, forcing the troops to retreat back to Haiti. Now, wrapping up this historical perspective, in 1808, after Napoleon invaded Spain, the Surrios of Santo Domingo revolted against the French rule, and with help from the United Kingdom, who was then Spain's ally, returned Santo Domingo to Spanish control. But of course, that begs the question as to how Haiti was forced into its present-day situation. Well, following its revolution, the United States and other European powers were terrified of the rippling effects of enslaved persons revolting and refused to recognize Haiti as a nation, which would have only been the second republic in the Western Hemisphere. Furthermore, emboldened by the posture of the United States and other European countries, France demanded a high payment for compensation to slaveholders who had lost their property, and Haiti was saddled with unmanageable debt for years to come. Now, in turn, Haiti has become one of the poorest countries in the Americas, while the Dominican Republic has grown to be one of the largest economies of both Central America and the Caribbean. So, we touched on for a quick second, on the institution of slavery through the course of Haitian history, but really to understand the nature of revolt, honestly, we have to kind of dive a bit deeper. Now, what I gave you just a second ago was really an overview of the history of Haiti, right? And we skipped through a lot of years, obviously, from 1492 when Columbus arrived until 1808, when Napoleon is essentially ceding, Dominican Republic back to Spanish rule. Well, we're going to get through and we're going to break down a lot of these years, so just bear with me, okay? Now, in 1664, the French West India Company took control of the French colony, and France formally claimed control of the western portion of Hispaniola. In 1665, the company established a French settlement on the mainland opposite Tortuga at Port de Paix. In 1676, the French changed the colony capital from Tortuga to Port de Paix, and in 1684, the French and Spanish signed the Treaty of Ratisbon, mainly focusing unified efforts to combat the actions of pirates and buccaneers who otherwise were running rampant through the Caribbean, intercepting and disrupting shipping routes between Europe and the Caribbean. Now, by the time the French and Spanish agreed to sign the Treaty of Ryswick, as we discussed before, farmers and planters grossly outnumbered the pirates, and with the encouragement of Louis XIV, the planters had begun growing tobacco, indigo, cotton, and coca, prompting the import of African slaves, with the economy eventually expanding to also include coffee and sugar. This single colony produced roughly 60% of all coffee consumed in Europe and 40% of all sugar, clearly a very, very important colony to the economy. Now, insurrections, rebellions, and escapes amongst the enslaved were frequent, with many of the escapees going to the mountains where they encountered and were taken in by surviving communities of the Taino natives. Now, by the second half of the 1780s, the island actually accounted for a third of the entire transatlantic slave trade, with the estimated population of enslaved Africans standing around 790,000. Between the mid-1960s and the early 1970s, it was averaged that the importation of human capital was about 10,000 to 15,000 people per year. But by 1786, that number had ballooned to 28,000. But that was dwarfed by 1787 and every year thereafter, where there was about 40,000 slaves imported every single year. There was a constant inability to maintain the enslaved population without a constant resupply from Africa. And so by 1789, approximately 500,000 enslaved Africans were ruled over by approximately 32,000 whites. At all times, a majority of the enslaved persons on the island were African-born, and the harsh conditions of slavery prevented growth from occurring naturally. To in essence legitimize slavery and provide some parameters for its operation, in 1685, Louis XIV enacted the Code Noir, which codified and afforded certain human rights to slaves and responsibilities to their masters, obligating the masters to feed and clothe and provide for the general well-being of the enslaved person. The code also sanctioned corporal punishment, which allowed masters to employ brutal methods to instill in their slaves the required docility, while selectively ignoring the provisions intended to regulate and govern the administration of the punishments. In writing about the atrocities suffered, a former enslaved person on the island was quoted as saying, "Have they not hung up men with heads downwards, drowned them in sacks, crucified them on planks, buried them alive, crushed them in mortars? Have they not forced them to eat excrement? And having flayed them with the lash, have they not cast them alive to be devoured by worms, or onto anthills, or lashed them to stakes in the swamp to be devoured by mosquitoes? Have they not thrown them into boiling cauldrons of cane syrup? Have they not put men and women inside barrels stuffed with spikes and rolled them down mountainsides into the abyss? Have they not co-signed these miserable blacks to man-eating dogs until the later, sated by human flesh, left the mangled victims to be finished off with bayonet and poniard? Now, as we've discussed before, many enslaved persons escaped the bondages of slavery by running away into the mountainous regions of the island, often forming communities of Maroons who would attack and raid many of the more isolated plantations. The most famous escaped enslaved person on the island was a man named Mackendall, a one-armed slave originally from Guinea who escaped in 1751. As a voodoo priest, Mackendall was able to unite many of the differing Maroon groups and then spent the next 6 years organizing and leading successful raids and evading French capture, having reportedly killed 6,000 people, preaching a vision of white colonial destruction on the island. In 1758, Mackendall led an unsuccessful plot to poison the drinking water of plantation owners, was captured, and set ablaze in the public square of Cap Francois. Now, I don't want to make it appear as though all of the Haitian colonization was doom and gloom for the Haitian people. In fact, the island boasted the largest and wealthiest free population of people of color in all of the Caribbean, known as the gens de couleur, or French for people of color. The mixed race persons on the island numbered around 25,000 by 1789, and as you can imagine, the first generation of the gens de couleur were typically of a similar offspring to mulattoes that many of our listeners are more familiar, children of French slave owners and African enslaved women. But unlike chattel slavery of the Americas, the French actually institutionalized this set of offspring, considering the semi-official name of placage, whereby the children were free people and permitted to inherit property, which by itself served to create the first variable middle class status between African enslaved persons and the pure blood French colonists. So let me take just about a minute to address what the last maybe 15, 20 minutes. Now, at the onset, I told you that to truly understand any revolution or unrest of a society, you must fully understand the nature of the social, economic, and political climate. Now, thus far, we've touched on the economic and the political, but really, let's hit the oppressive social construct that was codified in law. And for the sake of argument and reference, these laws were essentially the Haitian Jim Crow laws of their time. The commonly known reference to Jim Crow laws in the United States were not unique to American society or white American bigotry. In fact, the French colonists enacted a similar set of laws not less than 100 years prior to the southern states of America. The only fast forward aside I will offer to that point is that the Haitian people handled their systematic oppression really what I'll suggest was much better than the descendants of enslaved Africans in the United States. So as the numbers of gens de couleur swelled in size, French colonial rulers enacted discriminatory laws, including statutes that forbade the gens de couleur from obtaining certain professions, from marrying pure blood French whites, wearing European style clothing, carrying swords or even firearms in public, or even attending social functions where pure blood French whites were present. But these laws didn't go so far as to restrict the gens de couleur from purchasing property, meaning that while subjected to harsh discrimination, they were not prevented from accumulating great holdings of property, and some even owned slaves themselves. Now, I will not venture to legitimize the institution of slavery, nor the argument that many sympathizers, I'll suggest, attempt to make by saying that the institution was not as harsh because the blacks in some instance owned slaves too. So we'll just go forward with you all having that understanding of that vantage point. So please don't think that the foregoing was a complete or full history of Haiti either, prior to the revolution, but it just serves to give anyone who may not know just enough to really understand the climate ripe for revolution. If you or anyone wants to know the rich in-depth history of Haiti, I really do encourage you to do your own independent research. the Taino people, the Arawak people, had a rich history prior to Columbus's arrival in 1492. And obviously, you know, 20 minutes, 25 minutes is nowhere near enough time to really dive deep into all of the history. But I encourage you to read it. It's very, very interesting, especially if you do not know or are not aware already. So now that the framework for revolution has been laid, let's dive into the particular subject matter for today's episode. And as I've said before, this will probably emerge as one of our longer episodes of late, but I don't believe it's without good reason. Our longest in total were actually the episodes on modern Rastafarianism and Haile Selassie, but those, as you may remember, were broken into two episodes. This one we won't, so don't worry, we'll keep it all together and cover it all. Now, there's not much known with absolute certainty about the early life of Toussaint Louverture, and most of what we have comes from accounts provided by his second son, Isaac. And what Isaac provides is that Louverture's father was a man named Gao Guinou, who was the son of the king of Alada, a West African kingdom located in present-day Benin. According to Isaac, Louverture's father was captured during a war and subsequently sold into slavery. Louverture's mother was reportedly a woman named Pauline, the second wife of Guinou, and Louverture was the oldest child between the married couple. Now, as with many enslaved persons, Louverture's exact birth date is unknown, but his name would lead credence to the fact that he was born on or near All Saints' Day. He is thought to have been born on the St. Dominique plantation of Brita, and various sources, though none precise, provides a year of his birthday somewhere between 1739 and 1746. And like many others, Louverture himself may not have even been aware of his own birthday. Now, his born name was actually François Dominique Toussaint Louverture, with him actually adopting Louverture later in life. When he was a child, he was given the nickname Fatras Baton, which suggests that he was small and weak, but he would soon become better known for his abilities on horseback and his unwavering stamina when necessary. And without question, Louverture was an educated man, likely with much of the education being directly provided by his godfather, Pierre Baptiste. But no matter the source of his education, Louverture had a mastery of both French and Creole spoken language and a working intimate familiarity with ancient philosophy and Machiavelli. Now, there is a bit of confusion in the record, and according to sources, as to both when Louverture became a freed man and when he was married. What is known, however, is that Louverture married Suzanne Simone Baptiste, who was thought to be either his cousin, or the daughter of his godfather, or both. What is not known is whether the two married in 1777 or 1782. But what is known is that Louverture started life as an enslaved person and ended as a free man. What is not known, though, is whether his freedom was attained in 1776 or 1777. As it relates to the dates of his freedom, in one instance, there's actually a marriage certificate that indicates he was a freedman as of 1776, while in 1797, he was quoted as saying he had been free for 20 years. Now, I don't think that 1 year really makes too much of a difference, but, you know, just to keep the record straight. Now, in 1782, Louverture, before his death, he's alleged to have told a colleague that he had fathered 16 children, but nothing can be confirmed for sure, at least not past the three sons that, you know, are widely known of. Now, Louverture alleged that 11 of his children passed before he did himself. And when Louverture was on the Brita plantation, it would seem that he started off responsible solely for livestock, but as a freedman, he was a salaried employee that was the overseer, which essentially meant he was the slave driver and responsible for organizing the force. Now, the Haitian Revolution actually lasted from approximately 1791 to 1804, and essentially, it was a slave revolt in Saint-Dominique that culminated in the elimination of slavery on the island, and thereupon established the Republic of Haiti. Through the course of recorded history, it is the first and only slave rebellion that led to the founding of a state, and is generally considered to be the most successful slave rebellion to have ever occurred in all of the Americas. Beginning in 1789, the freed people of color were inspired by the French Revolution to expand their own rights and seek complete freedom. Incidentally enough, the enslaved persons on the island were not originally involved in the uprising. Now, the uprising officially started on August 14, 1791, during a voodoo ceremony at the Bois Cayman. Dutty Boukman was a prominent slave leader and a voodoo priest who gathered representatives from many of the nearby North plantations for both a spiritual and strategic meeting to plan the revolt against the ruling white planters of the North Plains. There is a particular prayer that is attributed to Dutty from that night. It goes something like this. Good Lord, who hath made the sun that shines upon us, that riseth from the sea, who maketh the storm to roar, and governeth the thunders. The Lord is hidden in the heavens, and there he watcheth over us. The Lord seeth what the Blancs have done. Their God commandeth crimes, ours giveth blessings upon us. The good Lord hath ordained vengeance. He will give strength to our arms and courage to our hearts. He shall sustain us. Cast down the image of the God of the Blancs, because he maketh the tears to flow from our eyes. Hearken unto liberty that speaketh now in all your hearts. Not long after the meeting on August 14th, the whole of the Northern Plain was in flames as the revolutionaries conducted organized acts of violence towards those that oppressed them. There have been numerous stories and tales as to the night and the events that transpired. The first time that the events were recorded was actually in 1814 by a man named Antoine Dalmas in his narrative, History of the Saint-Dominique Revolution. The events of August 14th are generally considered to be the official beginning of the Haitian Revolution. Now, as Antoine Dalmas was the first to record the events, we'll defer to him in his narrative for a general summary of the night. And he actually relays this. A man named Boukman, another Hungen, organized on August 14, 1791, a meeting with the slaves in the mountains of the north. This meeting took the form of a voodoo ceremony in Bou Cayman, in the northern mountains of the island. It was raining, and the sky was raging with clouds. The slaves then started confessing their resentment of their condition. A woman started dancing languorously in the crowd, taken by the spirits of the Loas. With a knife in her hand, she cut the throat of a pig and distributed the blood to all the participants of the meeting, who swore to kill all the whites on the island. A black pug surrounded by the slaves believed to have magical powers, each carrying the most bizarre offering, was offered as a sacrifice to the all-powerful spirit. The religious community in which the Negroes slit its throat, the greed in which they have believed to have marked themselves on the forehead with its blood, the importance that they have attached to owning some of the bristles which they believe would make them invisible. The ceremonial event that Dalmas described has been considered by many conservative Christian sources and more critical historians as the moment that the Haitian people made their pact with the devil. Now, let me say here that I don't agree with that statement or position at all. I do believe that religion and ceremony serves many different cultures and persons for different reasons, especially with the disconnect that's created between traditional African religious and ceremonial beliefs through the transcontinental slave trade. Now, I and most others would be missed to criticize or chastise the ceremonial practices of another people, especially in light of the fact that this was the moment, essentially, that galvanized the Haitian people to revolution, which I can't help but believe is part and parcel as to the categorization by many of the more conservative, and I surely put that in air quotes for those, obviously none of you can see it, but that conservatives in air quotes, I do believe that's part of the reason that they classify this moment as such, selling themselves to the devil. We've seen in most more recent history, actually, most recently, an evangelical minister suggested that the Haitian people essentially were paying for their former sins, referring to this moment here, because of the earthquake that hit Haiti just a few years back. And so we still hear the same narrative being perpetuated to today. And so this hasn't gone anywhere necessarily. Well, with a cohort Of approximately 600 former enslaved men, Leovator crossed into the Spanish-controlled eastern part of the island, serving with the Spanish army against the French, earning his stripes and perfecting his strategy. During his time with the Spanish, his forces grew steadily into a disciplined fighting force of over 4,000 men, including many French deserters. By about midway through 1794, Leovator and his men were ready for battle. So here's where history gets interesting. If you recall, the French Revolution actually started in 1789 and lasted until 1799. This gave the Haitians not only inspiration, but also a strategic advantage against the French. But this wouldn't be completely easy for them, as I'm sure you can imagine. When Leovator was marshaling his forces, the British saw an opportunity to gain colonial territory, and with their long-standing French feud, thought they could take advantage of the confusion on the island, and sent troops to try and put down the uprising. The British also thought that a successful uprising in Haiti might have residual effects and spread to their nearby island colony, famously known as Jamaica. When the British sent their troops, Leovator and his men abandoned the Spanish front and returned to Cape Francois to fight the British. Leovator defeated the British, freed an imprisoned French governor general, and with the help of Haitian mulattoes, helped rid the island of the British. Now, on August 29, 1793, Leovator made a famous declaration before his countrymen at Saint Dominique. "Brothers and friends, I am Toussaint Leovator. Perhaps my name has made itself known to you. I have undertaken vengeance. I want liberty and equality to reign in Saint Dominique. I am working to make that happen. Unite yourselves to us, brothers, and fight for the same cause." Now, on the same day as his proclamation, the French commissioner, Leger Félicite Sonthonax, made his own proclamation that all enslaved persons were to be emancipated, in hopes that the soldiers following Leovator would defect to his side. But this didn't work, probably because the soldiers following Leovator knew that Sonthonax was grossly exceeding the power of his own authority. And by 1796, Leovator was the dominant force in the fight for freedom. Even the resident French authorities respected him. But much of this was due to the fact that Leovator was as polished politically as he was militarily. We discussed before a bit of the hierarchy of society in the time prior to revolution, but the mulatto class was generally led by General André Rigaud. And though the mulattoes generally cooperated with Leovator's troops against the British, many of them secretly wished to reimpose slavery as they were higher in social status than most of the more African blacks at the time. In fact, before 1791, mulattoes had been free, and in many cases, many of them were substantial slaveholders. In general, General Rigaud and his troops wanted to participate with the French in governing their half of the island. But Leovator defeated General Rigaud and his troops when the time came, which we'll touch on a little bit later. The war between Leovator and Rigaud was called the War of Knives, lasting over a year, with Rigaud fleeing to Guadeloupe and then to France. While Leovator gets much of the credit, the War of Knives was really won by his lieutenant, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who became infamous during and after the war for massacring his mulatto captives and civilians alike. But Dessalines is potentially another person for another day, so we won't get into his legacy much. So that's the first thing Leovator did. And then he arranged for his French superiors to be sent as colonial representatives to the French Assembly in Paris. Now, in 1799, the infamous Napoleon Bonaparte took power in France and passed a new constitution that made French colonies subject to special laws. Initially, the colonies believed that Napoleon would reinstitute slavery, but he actually did the opposite. But Napoleon did forbid Leovator from reinvading the Spanish half of the island. By early 1801, Leovator's troops had captured Santo Domingo, the capital of the Spanish half of Hispaniola. With this capture, the entirety of the island was under Leovator's control. obviously, as I said before, Napoleon had attempted from France to ban Leo Vertor from invading the Spanish half. Clearly, this went directly against that directive. Once he had the whole island, he turned his attention into regenerating the economy and, in fact, rebuilt the plantation economy, which to me is a little bit shocking. You know, if you're going for liberation and for freedom of all people on the island under French control, you then rebuilt the plantation economy that kind of kept people under French thumbs. But either way, ironically, slave labor or other forced labor was the only way to get this kickstart going. And in fact, many of the former plantation owners returned to the island of administrators of the plantations. And by 1801, Hispaniola found a brief period of prosperity. Now, in March of 1801, Leo Vertor appointed a constitutional assembly made up predominantly of white planters to draft a constitution for the island. He himself signed the constitution on July 7th, 1801, thereby officially establishing his authority over the entire island of Hispaniola and made himself governor for life with near absolute powers and the sole responsibility for choosing his successor. The only thing Leo Vertor was careful not to do, however, was explicitly declare Saint Dominique's independence from France. Instead, in Article 1 of the Constitution, it states that Saint Dominique was just a colony of France. Article 3, however, did abolish slavery, reflecting, quote, "There cannot exist slaves. Servitude is therein forever abolished. All men are born, live, and die free and French." Leo Vertor published the Constitution and then wrote to Napoleon, essentially for approval of the document, but also to profess his loyalty to France and declare himself a Frenchman. Despite this, Napoleon refused to respond and eventually sent 20,000 of his men to Saint-Domingue to restore French authority. Leo Vertor's original plan was to scorch the earth, meaning he would burn the coastal cities and as much of the plains as possible and retreat with his troops into the mountains, generally inaccessible to those who were uninitiated until such time as fever would destroy the French army. For a number of reasons, the plan just didn't work out, and while the French had a weak position, Leo Vertor and his men never fully gained their military strength. On May 6, 1802, Leo Vertor negotiated an amnesty for all his remaining officers and retired to his plantations in Ennery. According to numerous historians, Dessalines was partially responsible for Leo Vertor's eventual arrest. Dessalines learned on May 22, 1802, that Leo Vertor failed to instruct a rebel leader to lay down his arms per the amnesty and ceasefire agreement we just mentioned. Now, in response to this, Dessalines wrote to the French governor and denounced Leo Vertor's failure and accepted gifts in return, which makes me question the genuineness, really, of Dessalines' report. But Leo Vertor was tricked by receipt of a letter, believing that he was invited to assist a, quote, "sincere friend" with plantation management. And needless to say, Leo Vertor was arrested and reportedly he warned his captors at the time, quote, "In overthrowing me, you have cut down in Saint-Domingue only the trunk of the Tree of Liberty. It will spring up again from the roots, for there are numerous and they are deep." And following his arrest, Leo Vertor was transported to France, arriving there on July 2nd, 1802, and on August 25th of the same year, he was sentenced to prison. On the 7th of April, 1803, Toussaint Leo Vertor died in prison, reportedly from exhaustion, malnutrition, apoplexy, pneumonia, and maybe even tuberculosis. Once he was deceased, Jean-Jacques Dessalines led the remainder of the French rebellion until its completion, completing its defeat of the French in 1803. So what is Toussaint Leo Vertor's legacy? You know, in kind of quick summation, Leo Vertor built the first Western-style modern black army in order to achieve his goal of emancipated slaves, profiting from the achievements of the former French civilization. His army defeated or managed to fend off every adversary they came across one after the other, from white planters adversarial-minded mulattoes from Saint-Domingue, other black insurgents, the Spanish Empire on the other end of the island, and even British imperialists. At one point, Napoleon dispatched two-thirds of the French Navy with an additional outpost of infantry to put down the revolution, but L'Ouverture was able to put that army down too. But in the course of the fighting, the French, L'Ouverture ended up in jail, or essentially, a prisoner of war. Napoleon sent his prisoner to a French prison to be put to death, but this really did nothing more than inspire Toussaint L'Ouverture's fellow freedmen to do what he'd always warned them against, initiating a total massacre of the white population of Haiti and declaring a total rupture of France, leading to emancipation, but also the current economic state of affairs that we see today. Even here in the United States, the Haitian Revolution influenced John Brown and the Harper's Ferry Rebellion. Now, Haiti is not some faraway land that's disconnected from the U.S. Haiti is the first black republic and the second independent country in the Western Hemisphere. In fact, the ties that bind the two countries of the U.S. and Haiti go back to the time when the U.S. was fighting for its own independence. A group of more than 500 Haitians, known as Les Chasseurs Volontaires de Savannah, fought in the 1779 Battle of Savannah, a monument in Franklin Square in downtown Savannah was erected in October of 2009 to commemorate those who actually fought in that battle. And after the Haitian revolt really started in 1791, many Saint-Domingueans eventually settled in Louisiana. In fact, the Louisiana Purchase was a direct consequence of the Haitian revolt. This land deal doubled the size of the U.S., adding to its holdings either in part or whole Louisiana, Arkansas, Nebraska, Missouri, Iowa, Oklahoma, Kansas, Minnesota, the Dakotas, Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana. As the first black independent country, with a story of a successful slave revolt, Haiti was a ray of hope for African Americans in the United States during the 19th century. Like France, the United States did not recognize Haiti's independence until 1862, precisely because white Americans worried that Haiti's existence challenged their own slave-driven economy. There were several immigration movements led by leaders such as Martin Delaney and James Theodore Holley, who encouraged African Americans to settle in Haiti. Although the majority of those who moved to Haiti returned to the U.S. due to linguistic and climatic issues, close to 20% of free blacks from the northern United States went to Haiti before the Civil War. This migration between Haiti and America forged links between the two countries. However, when the United States occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, changed Haiti's constitution, and in many ways further contributed to its ongoing instability, many African Americans denounced the occupation of a sovereign nation. So, from time to time, we receive requests for episodes, and this episode was surely probably the most requested. But before the research was done, I had known of the legacy of Toussaint L'Ouverture, but, you know, honestly, never really knew the whole history of Haiti, and really never knew the whole history of L'Ouverture himself. If there's an episode that you would like to hear, a topic that you'd like to discuss, please do not hesitate to let us know. Honestly, you can reach out to us the same way one of our listeners did on Twitter. I believe her name is Iezon, and she's on Twitter as IVIEA. I believe that'd be like IVA, maybe. She did most recently. She shot us a message, a direct message, as a matter of fact, and asked me to do this episode. Or you can just send us an email. The email address is info@thisiscarrington.com. I hope you really did enjoy this episode, learned something valuable. I hope it didn't run too long, and we were potentially able to clarify something that you otherwise didn't fully understand about the Haitian Revolution or Toussaint L'Ouverture. In the event you have any questions or general commentary about today's episode, please feel free to visit our website at www.blackhistorypodcast.com and click podcast at the upper right-hand corner. Send your feedback to us as well. Suggest new topics, events, or people we should cover. And, you know, like I said, today's episode was probably the most requested one that I've ever received. So it had to be covered. You know, we'll make every best effort to include commentary and requests for episodes in future shows that we'll do. And, you know, as always, as we continue this journey together, we will continue to do our best to present the diaspora in the most objective light with some occasional commentary. But as always, if you come across any errors or mistakes, please let us know. You know, give us a rating in the iTunes Store, Google Play as well. Because as we like to say here, only steel can sharpen steel. Take care and catch you next time.